the Senate Committee on Rules for February 18th, 2010. We have three public hearings today. Just to state for the record again, we are at the point in the session where the Rules Committee will operate like a Rules Committee. And while we will hold public hearings now on these bills, should the bills come back for work sessions, those work sessions may only last 2 or 3 minutes at the longest. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3638A. Could the committee administrator give a brief overview, and could Representative Hanna, the Republican leader of the House, come forward?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3638A prohibits former members of Legislative Assembly from employment as public officials in state government for 1 year from their time their legislative service ends, unless position is advertised for not less than 2 weeks, minimum qualifications do not include legislative service, and employer considers other qualified candidates, does not apply to judicial office, and position subject to Senate confirmation. This bill comes to you off the House floor on a 6-0 vote.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I appreciate the opportunity to be in front of you today. House Bill 3638 is an important bill to ensure that legislators are not using their current position within the legislature to obtain higher-paying jobs in state government. Oregonians have understandably been cynical about possible conflicts of interest. I think this is a bill which, by its bipartisan nature, has resolved some of the issues. We all know that legislators have extraordinary power to shape public policy and do have the opportunity to spend billions of dollars of Oregon taxpayers' money. When legislators leave their currently low-paying jobs in the legislature for higher-paying jobs in the executive branch, both the members' financial and political motivations have been questioned. To eliminate any doubt, House Bill 3638 imposes a one-year waiting period on legislators before they can seek and obtain these salaried, non-elected positions in the executive branch. This waiting period assures that legislators can't use their position to win lucrative state jobs, and it guarantees they wouldn't be able to leverage their power and inside connections to get the position they want. I am pleased, as I mentioned, to mention that House Bill 3638 is very much a bipartisan bill, an example of how we can work together to solve a problem. Along with the chair of House Rules and other colleagues, we identified four compromise measures that are included in the bill you see before you today. The first is the one-year waiting period, which establishes a clear and consistent standard for legislators before they can move to the executive branch. The second exempts positions that require Senate approval. These positions are already subject to the public debate and scrutiny, both in the Senate rules and on the Senate floor. The third exempts appointments to the judicial branch, and this is simply to ensure that the legislation only applies to executive branch, which was the original intent of the bill. And the fourth compromise allows a former member to take a position in state government so long as recruitment for the position is advertised, the minimum qualifications do not include legislative service, and the employer considers other qualified applicants. And obviously, this is to ensure that legislators have to compete with other Oregonians for these positions. In closing, House Bill 3638 sends a strong message to Oregonians that the legislature is about public service, not about using the office as a stepping stone for personal opportunities within state government. Thank you very much, and I would ask that you would move the bill forward.
Any questions? Yes, Senator Ferriola.
I do have a question, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I think this is a great step. I just was curious about why there was no prohibition against the offering of such employment to legislators. You know, there's perhaps only anecdotal evidence, perhaps it's even reduced to the level of gossip. But we hear frequently that offers are made. You know, I heard things that offers are made to seated legislators by executives within the administration or the executive branch, or even, heaven forbid, by Oregon's chief executive, whomever that may be at the time. And I just wondered if we're going to prohibit the seeking of such employment with this bill, Perhaps then we would, at some future date, also consider the concurrent sort of prohibition against the offering of these jobs, as we do with some of the other ethics rules on contributions, et cetera, and gifts. So just sort of an aside observation, and perhaps not even a question there, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. I understand the statement. Any additional questions? Okay. I do believe there's a parallel to that, though not exactly analogous, is that in campaigns you cannot offer by state law future employment in state government to a person. I believe that is in statute who is working on a campaign.
All right. And Mr. Chairman, that's a great observation. I guess that is a good analogy. But it's usually the person of greater power offering some blandishment to the person of lesser power.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, if I may?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, I hear you clearly. I believe this is an issue that Oregonians spoke clearly about, and it was every attempt was made to shine a bright light on the employment practice. I don't believe it's the goal of any legislator or of Oregonians in general to prohibit or to keep legislators out of the pool. That's simply not our intent. The intent is to make it a fair process by which either the position, as we mentioned, has Senate approval, or that you are competitive with other Oregonians for the job. And the idea is shine the bright light and make sure that Oregonians feel like we heard them clearly and we have taken measures to correct any perception. Whether there was wrongdoing or not, any perception of that wrongdoing, and prevent those type of things from happening in the future.
Okay. Any additional questions?
No.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do we have other people set to testify?
I don't.
No.
Well, I'd like to ask the Legislative Council some questions.
Yes, if they are here. Gina? Okay. Gina, if you could state your full name for the record.
Spell it. That's the hard part.
There'll be a quiz later. My name is Gina Zedlick from the Office of Legislative Counsel.
Thank you. Gina, just a couple questions here. This applies to a public official, but I can't find the definition of what a public official is. Can you help us so I understand the scope of who would be considered a public official?
Yes. A public official is defined for purposes of the ethics laws in ORS 244020. So I'll just read that. It means any person who, when an alleged violation of this chapter occurs, is serving the state of Oregon or any of its political subdivisions or any other public body as defined in ORS 174109 as an elected official, appointed official, employee, or agent, irrespective of whether the person is compensated for the services. And I don't have the bill in front of me that you're talking about, but it I believe it refers to state government.
Yes.
Which is a very broad definition. State government means the executive department, the judicial department, and the legislative department.
Okay, so what this would encompass is it's not just the executive branch. You couldn't work in the legislature for as an employee, or a public official is an employee, is part of the definition, or a custodian at the Fish and Wildlife Office in Portland or whatever. That would all be considered a public official, correct?
Yeah, Chair Devlin, Senator Metzger, yes.
Okay, so, and then state government is all three branches, so it's not just the executive branch.
Yes.
The employee, exactly. Anywhere.
Yeah.
With these exceptions. Okay, so let's give you an example of how this would be. Does this in any way restrict, and is there any constitutional issue, restricting the chief executive from hiring? I mean, are we able, for example, to tell the governor, because not everything he appoints is subject to Senate confirmation, that if Senator Farioli was to be asked to be his chief of staff, that does this in any way restrict the governor's ability to appoint people that he has currently authority to appoint without necessarily having these restrictions?
Chair Devlin, Senator Metzger. Right now, as the bill as written would not have an exception for that type of position. This would apply to those types of positions. except the one specifically exempted.
Right. So, then my second part of that question, is there any constitutional issue by restricting the government's ability, the governor's ability, the executive branch, or the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court to tell them who they can and cannot employ? Is there any constitutional issue with that?
Chair Devlin, Senator Metzger, off the top of my head, I don't think there is, because it doesn't actually prevent, their hiring. It just qualifies the type of the process that would have to be used to do that hiring.
Okay. So. Okay. Another question, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
So, so let's say Secretary of State Brown or Avakian, labor, could not perform their duties. And the governor now has the ability to appoint a replacement, not subject to the Senate. He can do that. Would the governor be restricted as to who he could appoint to be Secretary of State or Avakian because they would be an official and they're not elected yet? They're being appointed. They would at some point be subject to election. Would this apply? They'd have to advertise the Secretary of State position, or how would that work?
Chair Devlin, Senator Metzger, I think the way the bill is written, it says holds, and one of the exceptions is that the person would hold an elective public office, and so that was written more broadly and generally, so it wasn't that you have to be elected to the office, but that the office itself is an elective office.
Yes.
So, yeah, the answer to that question would be no, he
okay.
could appoint.
And then one final question, Mr. Chair, for me anyway. So another example, we've had some different people with different occupations in the legislature. Let's say, and we've had these, a state trooper.
Mm-hmm.
And so he leaves that employment to serve in the legislature and wants to go back when his term is over December 31st to be a state trooper. Is he not eligible to go back and now and be a state trooper without competing with everyone else to be a state trooper? Or how? Because that he would be a public employee of a branch of government. Would he not be able to return to his profession in the 4 years?
Senator Devlin, Chair Metzger, yes, I believe that's the way it would work. If I became a member of the Legislative Assembly and wanted to go back and work at Legislative Council, they would have to interview other people and go through that process. There was no exception made for returning to your former
employer. Representative Hanna was shaking his head, so maybe you could come forward on that, because that's one of the concerns I have. We have making sure that people don't lose their profession if they were working for any branch of another part of government.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, it's my understanding as we went through the process that specific question is answered by a state trooper specifically. The only difference is it would still be a position that is advertised. So if that person was a member of the legislature, finished their term, wanted to go back to a position, number one, positions for state trooper are positions that are currently advertised and competitive among all Oregonians or those qualified candidates. So they could return to that position.
Right. I guess the only question was I had on that, Representative, was in some cases now people are allowed to leave that service because you can't have two lucrative offices. They're allowed to leave, but under contract or others, they're allowed to return to that position. In other words, you don't have to compete for it. They're allowed to return, because they took that leave or whatever to do that. And I just wonder if that would in any way impact that, the guarantee that they can go back and work, or is it just a guarantee that, well, you can compete for it again, but we can't necessarily say that if you take a leave to become a representative that we can ensure that you'll have a job when you come back? I guess that's what I was thinking of.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, I think you're going to have to rely on legal counsel for that particular. Our intent, I will tell you,
is to make
that opportunity absolutely available, and the way we did that was to qualify that the position was competitive. What I'm hearing you say is maybe slightly different in that we're holding the position for them, or it's an extended leave of absence, and I think we're going to ask counsel.
Chair Devlin, Senator Metzger, I think you'd have to, the bill reads that the person cannot take a position, so maybe if there was some sort of contract where they never really lost their position, maybe that would be a possibility. However, I guess if that's something that you would like to specify, I think it would
it would probably need to be changed in the bill, because I think right now the most conservative read of that would be that, yes, you need to, even if that was your former position, it would still need to be advertised.
Okay. Anything additional?
That's my question.
Okay, I have a question. Maybe I'm misreading, but on page 3 of the bill, sub B, sub A, this subsection does not apply to a person who has been a member of the legislature who holds an elected public office. How do I interpret that in regards, I'm trying to just read this very quickly. I have a member who actually holds another elected public office. He is a community college board member, which is an elective office. I have previously had school board members. How would that be interpreted? Would they be exempted from the law?
Chair Devlin, I'm sure that was not Representative Hanna's intent. However, that would be an interpretation of the word.
Maybe Representative Hanna, did you want to
more
respond?
Clear.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. But I mean, obviously, we're getting into details of law and or written rule potentially. That again, the intent is quite clear, and to further dive into those type of legal details, we might have to get there. The intent is quite clear.
Okay. Any additional questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you, Representative Hanna.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I didn't see you.
So fascinated by thinking about, okay, now if I was elected mayor.
Now, mayor you probably couldn't do. You can be...
So if I'd been in a legislative assembly and it was within a period of time and I was elected mayor, could I then take a state job?
Well, the definition, we're not going to get into that level of detail.
Okay, the definition
of lucrative office is not what we would consider a real definition of lucrative office. I know city councilors who get $20 a month in terms of expense allowance, and that's considered a lucrative office.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it doesn't have to be very lucrative. Mr. Chairman, I do have a question.
Yes, to legislative counsel.
Yes, ma'am.
Or yes, sir.
To Ms. Zedlick. In the unengrossed version, we refer to regular legislative sessions as the time period. We're referring a question to the voter about making them annual, and I wondered how that would affect the outcome of this designation of legislative sessions as the timeout period.
Chair Devlin, Senator Farioli, are you referring to something other than the A engrossed version?
I had been earlier. I guess I'm wondering if the A engrossed version.
The A engrossed version just does a 1 year time.
Thank you very much.
That
answers the question. Thank you.
Anything additional? Thank you very much, Representative Hanna. Thank you, Gina. Okay, I will close that public hearing, and I'm going to open a public hearing. What's wrong with 36, 37? I will open a public hearing on 3686A. Could the committee administrator give a brief overview? Could Speaker Hunt come forward? He was here. Could Speaker Hunt come forward at this time?
Doesn't hear you, Johnny.
Can you give the overview?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3686A adds obligation of school district, education service district, or public charter school to maintain religiously neutral work environment to factors for determining whether reasonable accommodations under Oregon Workplace Religious Freedom Act require significant difficulty or expense, repeal statute prohibiting teacher in any public school from wearing religious dress while engaged in the performance of duties as a teacher, and sanction teacher for doing so. This measure comes to you from my floor with a 51-8-1 vote.
Speaker Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Representative Dave Hunt.
This, as your committee staff has indicated, this bill does come with a broad bipartisan vote, one of those interesting votes where the 8 no votes were 4 Republicans and 4 Democrats in the House. Very broad bipartisan support. And I think if you look at the organizations, I'm not sure, Mr. Chair, if you have a copy of this list of organizations. If you don't, we'll make sure we get this to you as well.
I would like to actually
okay.
have that.
So my staff will make sure that we get that. But a very wide range of groups from the Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon to the Oregon Family Council, the Jewish Federation, the Muslim Citizens Alliance, the PSU Muslim Student Association, the Urban League, the Northwest Religious Liberty Association, a huge range of people of all faith across the spectrum who have come together really with two core principles. One, that we should guarantee the free exercise of religion to all Oregonians, even if they happen to be teachers. And secondly, that there is still a balance to be maintained to prevent the establishment of religion by government. This really is about how we can maintain both of those. It goes back to 1923 when the then Speaker of the House, whose name, interestingly enough, was Caspar K. Kubley, KKK. The KKK had very strong representation in the governor's office at the time in both bodies of the legislature, and passed this law, this ban on religious clothing in the classroom, specifically aimed at the time at Catholic nuns. Obviously, things have dramatically changed in Oregon since then. We are much more religiously pluralistic as a state now, and the application of that law is much, much broader in its discriminatory sweep. We think it's time that we recognize that people of different faiths can live and work and even be educated together in a way that allows them to freely exercise their religion but does not burden their or proselytize their religion on people, in this case on students. This, as I said, workplaces across Oregon already have protections in terms of religious free exercise. Interestingly enough, the ban does not even apply today to principals or instructional assistants, teaching aides, coaches. It only applies to teachers, because that's what the 1923 ban was focused on. And so this, first and foremost, will repeal that 87-year-old ban. Secondly, you will notice in the last section of the bill, on page 2, lines 16 through 18, subsection F adds a new ability to districts to restrict. Since we will be lifting the ban, it does give districts an explicit tool to be able to restrict clothing in cases where the religious neutrality of the work environment in those schools is threatened. So it's very much trying to maintain that balance. How do we allow free exercise of religion, but also not allow teachers or allow schools to be able to establish religion? It also, you'll notice in the last line there that it takes effect in July 2011. The original version of the bill would have taken effect in January 1st. We've given that additional 6 months specifically so Foley, working with the Department of Education, can put together a broadly diverse group, the whole education spectrum, the entire religious spectrum, the ACLU, other interested parties, can come together to make sure the implementation rules are right, that they're written in a way that does allow teachers the right to religious free exercise without allowing teachers or schools to proselytize. 47 other states already have either repealed these laws or never adopted them in the first place. We are one of only 3 states that has a ban on teachers wearing religious clothing in the classroom. It's Oregon, Nebraska, and Pennsylvania, which is an interesting threesome. And we have the most restrictive ban of the 3. This would basically send a very clear message that we should judge our teachers based on their ability to teach, based on their effectiveness as teachers, not by the fact that they may happen to be a member of a particular faith that requires religious clothing. So I commend this bill to you. As was said, it passed with very broad bipartisan support in the House, and I think it's time to, as we have over the last several decades, this is one piece of remaining discrimination that happens to remain in our statutes dating back 87 years. It's time to repeal it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions for Representative Hunt? Senator Ferriola.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, does the bill define religious dress?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, the current ban on religious clothing does not have a very explicit definition of religious clothing. This will lift that ban. So the terminology for religious clothing, the only terminology that will remain, if you look in current statute, it is actually in here. Let me find it. If you look in, so this is not anything new added in this bill, but this is an existing statute on page 1 of the bill, line 18, where it references religious clothing. And I think it is referenced similarly. Well, that may be the only reference to religious clothing. I think the rules that BOLI and DOE will write will likely get into to some of those specific issues. I know the BOLI commissioner is here and may have some specific answer to that. We are, by repealing ORS 342, 650, and 655, we'll be removing the current language, that the ban language, and so those references to religious clothing will no longer be in statute.
Additional questions? Okay. Thank you very much, Representative Hunt.
Thank you.
Could Commissioner Avakian come forward?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Brad Avakian, State Labor Commissioner. I appreciate you very much inviting me to the hearing this afternoon to discuss this particular bill. We would be the state agency, as we run the state civil rights division, that would implement the bill. I'm familiar with the amendments that you have before you. I think that the amendments that you have can be implemented fairly by the agency. I thought that it would be important to talk a little bit about the law with respect to what it is, whether or not you were to pass this bill. The United States Constitution, First Amendment, of course, contains the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. The Free Exercise Clause, of course, protecting the individual's right to express religious beliefs in appropriate ways, even in public places. The Establishment Clause, the competing clause, limiting government's role in establishing religions. Now, the reason I mentioned the First Amendment is because that law, as interpreted by the Supreme Court, controls even school settings, regardless of what you do with the statute that you have before you now. The really the one of the most significant cases that set out the standard that governs religious expression and government involvement in public places was a case called Lemon v. Kurtzman. And it gave you three standards, and those standards would apply in the situations you have before you now. One is that the government action cannot have some type of a secular purpose. Now, that's analogous to what you have in a teacher wearing some type of religious dressing. The government action must have some type of a secular purpose. It also can neither inhibit nor advance religion. It also cannot establish some type of an entanglement between government and religion. Now, that test has survived the years since the 1970s when it was instituted, and even if you were to adopt the amendment in the bill that you have before you, that test would still govern religious garb in public school settings today, meaning that garb could not create some type of an excessive entanglement between religion and between the school. If it did, it would be precluded by the First Amendment. In addition to that, you may have information from the Department of Education, who have their own set of statutes that govern enforcement of these types of situations, where any citizen in the state of Oregon could make a complaint that religious neutrality was being breached in a classroom, and there's an entire judicial process set up within the Department of Education that can preclude it if it's affecting the religious garb, proselytizing, any type of action is affecting the school environment. Now, I mention these things only because it's very important to consider that in all of these constitutional tests, there is a balancing of interests. Just like in the First Amendment, where you have the Free Exercise Clause and the Establishment Clause, it's a balancing of individual interests against the limitations on state. The problem with the existing statute is that there is no balance to it. It is a complete preclusion on any religious garb worn by a teacher in the classroom. The Cooper decision, which if you have not heard of already, you will in testimony, was authored by Justice Lindy of the Oregon Supreme Court, who upheld under the state constitution the existing statute. And he uses in his analysis this balancing of interests, just like I've described. But what I think is the most important sentence for you to consider from that decision and in deciding what you do with this bill is where Justice Lindy also says that the statute might indeed restrict a teacher's First Amendment rights to free exercise more than necessary if it were applied literally. And the test that is always considered first in whether or not a statute is valid is if you take the language as is written in the statute, is it constitutional? And even Justice Lindy and Cooper concludes that it might not be. And that is the primary reason why you have the United States Attorney General considering filing a lawsuit against the state of Oregon right now over the existing statute and why it needs to be repealed. My guess, Mr. Chair and Senators, is that I think you're never going to find a place of comfort with this issue. This is a sticky issue that has been around since the Constitution was written, and that isn't going to change. And frankly, I don't think it should change. I think in a free society where you have these competing interests, there is an inherent tension that should be there, and that cases should be resolved on a case-by-case basis. I think that the amendments you have before you and the repeal of this statute at least gets us to a place where we have competing interests again rather than a complete preclusion on individual rights. With that, Mr. Chair, I will end, and I would encourage the committee, since I have the agency that will be implementing it, to feel free to ask questions that are important to you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator Burdick.
What this really is about is what people wear in the classroom. And so I wanted to ask you, what are the requirements just in general? I mean, how much discretion does a school district have in, regardless of religion, but just in general, to dictate to teachers and people in the classroom what they can wear while they're teaching?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator, the school settings are treated uniquely under the law, constitutionally and in many ways statutorily, because it's important to accommodate a learning environment that is good for all the students that are there. And so, in a very general sense, school districts have great authority in managing their environment so it's conducive to learning, and that would apply in free speech types of issues, what teachers can say and can't say, in this type of religious garb issue, what they can wear and what they can't, and in other non-constitutional issues like what's just appropriate dress and what isn't appropriate dress. School districts have great latitude to create a good learning environment.
Because, Mr. Chair, it occurred to me that maybe just one way of getting around this is to just take the limitations, because my problem with this bill is it kind of gets the government into deciding what's a religion and what isn't. What kind of garb meets the criteria for religious. I mean, one person could come in and say, you know, that they're wearing shorts and a tank top is part of their religion. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but maybe one way to get around this is to just say anything goes in the classroom.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think the concept that you're coming up with and how you draw the line is a very important concept. I certainly think it would be a mistake to go from one extreme, a complete preclusion, to another extreme in which anything goes. School districts have to be able to maintain control of their learning environment. The question really is it valid to have a statute on the books that allows that control, but at the expense of completely precluding any individual or constitutional right on free expression of religion from an individual, which is what we have now. And I think that the proper place to be is in the middle, where you have a process that allows for the balancing of those interests. The statute that the Department of Education uses in order to adjudicate these types of disputes is set up perfectly to look at the various interests and come to conclusions, just like the process the Bureau of Labor and Industries uses in religious discrimination cases is set up in order to take evidence and find the balance between the two.
And Mr. Chair, this is another source of the problem, because religion, under our non-discrimination statutes, religious preference or religious practices is a protected class, as it should be. So what is the nexus? For example, if someone showed up in some kind of religious garb that was, for whatever reason, disruptive to the classroom, it upset the children or whatever, and so the school district decided to use their discretion in that case, not because of the religion, but because of the effect it was having, then couldn't that person turn around and use their protected status under the discrimination statutes to undo that decision by the school district?
Mr. Chair, Senator, if the law does not change, you have a situation where the school district would have complete authority to deny the wearing of the religious garb, and the individual, unlike virtually any area of law we have in this state, would have absolutely no recourse in any forum to contest it. That's what the law is now if you do nothing. If you do the repeal, the person could make a claim at the Bureau of Labor and Industries for religious discrimination. We would undergo that same type of balancing test I described, balancing the right of the individual with the right of the school district to maintain the environment that I described. And so we would take a balanced approach to see which, and if the evidence were to show that the garb either destroyed the neutrality of religion in the classroom or created some type of an undue hardship on the school district in maintaining a classroom environment that was conducive to learning, then those could trump the individual right.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that.
Additional questions? Yes, Senator Ferriol.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's the same general theme that I had explored with the speaker, and that is, if there's no definition of religious garb, what are we talking about?
Mr. Chair and Senator, there's no black and white definition. I'm not sure that that's achievable. There certainly are Supreme Court cases that discuss and at least provide an analysis for what constitutes a closely held religious belief or a valid religion. There certainly are cases in Oregon, not legal cases, but situations in which an individual wears something that appears to be religious in nature but is really cultural in nature, and therefore the law may not even apply, although it's difficult for a third person to discern what it is. These are, I think, factual differences in situations that really show why a forum is needed in order to draw conclusions, as opposed to having statutes that in a blanket way draw conclusions before the facts are even presented.
And Mr. Chairman, follow on?
Yes.
Mr. Commissioner, I think it would be helpful in the rulemaking process to give some definitions. And the reason I suggest that is that there are some religions that are global in nature and clearly recognized of long-standing, of sincere core belief, who, as part of their religious costume, add edged weapons. And, you know, I'm certain that you will find that that would conflict with school policies. But there's no question that they are, in fact, exhibiting religious garb. Just absolutely no question of that. So I that may one of your first, be one of your first cases. Other religions, perhaps closer to the Northwest culture, revere fur and animal parts as part of their religious expression. Native Americans. Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to cause some consternation for people. And we may find a threshold of political correctness being defined as disruptive in some instances. For instance, if a person wore fur as part of their religious expression, which may not be palatable for political reasons or others, that may be perfectly valid as a religious expression. So I think definitions are going to be an important part of this, and I expect that that will be undertaken in the rulemaking process for the implementation of this. So I just urge you to, you may not ever be able to perform in a perfect manner, but I think you owe an obligation to try to get some definitions in there. Mr. Chairman, I have a similar concern about obviously membership in a recognized church is not a criterion for determining whether these are sincerely held beliefs. So you've already mentioned that you're going to do this on a case-by-case basis.
I'd Mr. Like Chair, would you like me to comment?
I would.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator, you bring up excellent points. I think governments have to be very careful in a rulemaking or a statutory process to make sure that as they try and define, provide clarity to the rules, that they don't have the consequence of precluding individual rights by the parameters that they set. It's a very difficult balance to find. It's one of the reasons we over 200 years ago left England and came here, was because parameters were set by governments that precluded certain types of free expression. But I do agree with you, and I'm very glad that you put it on the record, that in any action that my agency takes or that this body takes, those considerations have to be taken seriously.
And Mr. Chair, finally, the
yes.
I think the places where you will be the most comfortable is where we have a fairly clearly defined sector of practitioners who will be able to, by example, demonstrate that this is religious garb, and you may be required to do something pro forma about the sincere holding of these beliefs, but in many cases the issue of sincerely held beliefs will be self-defined. And so what prevents an individual from being as clear in their expression or as varied in their expression of a religious garb as human beings are capable of being in the expression of their religious closely held beliefs?
Mr. Chair, Senator, what you're describing is really kind of the first step in the analysis of a case in whether or not you even have a religious garb as compared to something else. Even if that standard is met, then the individual still does not, per se, get the right to wear it. Because if a school district is able to show that it inhibits the ability of children to learn in a class, or that it destroys the neutrality of religion in that public setting, then the state can preclude the wearing of the religious garb. And that is probably the most important part of the test. I am a strict separationist between church and state. And even given my position that this statute needs to be repealed, it is consistent, because that strict separation must still have a balance between individual interests and interests of the state, with neither one precluded completely. So our analysis in implementing this law will be not only to look at the definitions that you're describing, but then second and most important, to know whether or not that particular garb in that particular setting inhibits the ability of children to learn or destroys the neutrality between church and state.
And finally, Mr. Chairman, you know, this is, it's I'm not envious of the position that this will put you in as the director of this agency, but just in general, upon whom will you place the burden of proof?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it's a shifting burden of proof. There certainly is a burden on the individual on whether or not the garb that is being worn is religious in nature. But there is a burden on the state in order to articulate a reason that it should be prevented. And the burden on the state would be to show that it has in some way negatively affected the ability of children to learn in that classroom, or is entangling the state with religion in some way. And so there are differing burdens of proof depending on what part of the case you're talking about. That's how I will implement it.
Mr. Chairman, I see tremendous encouragement in this bill. Encouragement to those who wish to have the free expression of their religious affiliation be honored, and to those new young graduates of our law schools.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I guess I just have to take that bait.
You're pretty easy.
We're only one, I think, of three states that has such a preclusion like this, and the other states don't. And I don't think there are lawyers getting rich anywhere else in the country over these types of issues. There have not been a lot of cases. As a matter of fact, there have been virtually no cases dealing with this kind of situation we're talking about. So I'm expecting that lawyers in Oregon will have to try and make a living doing something else.
Mr. Chairman, there didn't used to be appraisal management service organizations either. But we passed a law. So, anyway, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm.
I did have actually a couple of questions. Thank you, Senator Ferriero. I have read the bill and actually read a lot of the materials that have come to me, both by mail and by email. One thing that came up today, I think you've probably looked at the bill closely, looked at the issue very closely, Commissioner Avakian. But a member told me today that if I was a teacher and I wore a tie clasp that was a cross or a Star of David, that would be permissible. But if I wore some other type of religious clothing, it might not. Or how do you reconcile those two practices?
Mr. Chair, committee members, it's another excellent question, and it illustrates exactly why there must be a balance test rather than a complete preclusion. A small one-inch cross might or might not be allowable in a classroom, depending on what it is doing to the environment of that particular classroom and that particular community. A one-inch cross might have one effect, whereas a 12-inch cross might have a different effect. And that's why you have the balancing test that I described. It's why you have the shifting burdens of proof that I described. It's why in the Cooper decision, Justice Lindy does an excellent job of illustrating how some degree of garb might be acceptable, but other degrees of garb might not be acceptable. That's the type of balance we want out of our law in this state. The problem is the statute as it is does not allow for that. It's a complete preclusion.
I can't get away with actually making a little dig at attorneys. We have plenty of them, actually, in the legislature now.
Actually, more than enough, I'd say, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, the Republican leader and the Democratic leader in agreement.
But in terms of separation of church and state, and in terms of freedom of religious expression, from just a layperson's thing point of view, the issue that troubles me most about this, that is, if a person had a clear religious belief that actually required them to actually wear some type of attire, as modest as that attire might be, or to wear something else, as modest as that might be, and they thought their vocation in life was to be a teacher, under the way the law is written now, they would have to choose between their vocation in life or their religious belief. That's what really troubles me the most about the way the law is currently written. Can you respond to me about that troubling fact? Because the original bill that we passed was to expand religious freedom. But with the way the law is written now, you're saying that a person, not you personally, but I'm saying the way the statute is written, they would have to choose between their religious belief and their vocation in terms of their life if they wanted to be a teacher.
Well, Mr. Chair, committee members, you've stated accurately what the effect of the current law is. And there are situations in which individuals have made the choice to not be a teacher in Oregon because of that. And I have to add, that shows that the law is working exactly as it was intended in 1923. When this law was passed in 1923, it was meant to completely preclude Catholics from being in public schools, and so it's working as intended. That's the problem with it. I think the answer, at least theoretically, lies here. If there's anything that we hold dear in this country, even when it makes it uncomfortable, is to make sure that individuals have the rights that are guaranteed to them under the Constitution and by law. And we nearly always default to making sure that we don't infringe on those individual rights unless there is really a compelling government reason to do so. Our law doesn't allow for that. Our law is a complete preclusion on individual rights. That's the problem with it. If you repeal, as is before you now, you end up in a place where you're allowed to have a balancing of interests, to respect individual rights until there's a reason not to. In this case, that reason would be infringing on the learning environment of a school or an entanglement between religion and government that is not permitted. That's the place I think we need to get to.
Thank you. Anything additional? Thank you very much, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Andrea Meyer. I'm going to do it by twos. Steve.
Mr. Chair. Good afternoon.
Cynthia.
Chair Devlin.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. I mean, here today in opposition to this version of House Bill 3686, engrossed. I've provided, or you will shortly get, some written testimony on the current bill and the concerns we have, and I will cover some other things in the amendment, and I will try to summarize my testimony because I could go on, but I won't. This is a difficult issue, and we appreciate the challenges and the good people on both sides of this. ACLU recognizes the religious liberty rights of individuals and their ability to practice their faith, and indeed we've supported and will continue to support those efforts here in Oregon across the country. But public schools have a special obligation and a unique role to ensure an atmosphere that is welcoming to all students and their families, regardless of their religious beliefs. To quote just one excerpt out of Cooper that you've already heard referenced today when the court upheld the law in 1986,
In excluding teachers whose dress is a constant and inescapable visual reminder of their religious commitment, laws like ORS 342-650 respect and contribute to the child's right to free exercise and enjoyment of its religious opinions and heritage untroubled by being out of step with those of the teacher. So during the school day, the public school teacher are representative of the government, and their appearance and their actions are taken on behalf of the government. And in this context, it is where the government and the school needs to ensure religious neutrality during the school day. I want to try to address some issues that have been raised by some questions, and also to refer to you all the dash two amendments that I believe you have before you and talk about those briefly. Call to your attention a letter from the Attorney General of the State of Oregon, who wrote on January 13th about this legislation. And briefly, Attorney General Kroger has, in examining the law and any potential litigation challenges to the current law by the U.S. Department of Justice, has made clear in his statement that they, at this point, although their analysis is not complete, are quite confident in the law being upheld. And he also notes that if the statute's amended or repealed, as I think Senator Farioli noted, it is an opportunity for lots of litigation with parents challenging. And these are complex issues. And indeed, ACLU has been challenged with this in our board since meeting in November to try to figure out how and if we can get to a place is challenged by this. But in the effort to bring language that would at least get us to neutral, I'd like to take a moment to go over some things. You've heard some testimony, and I want to add to why it's a particularly complicated issue here in Oregon. You've heard testimony about the infamous, I think it's now infamous, Lemon v. Kurtzman test, because I think there is no U.S. Supreme Court justice who likes that test. And that indeed is the current standard for First Amendment analysis, but what is complicated in Oregon, as you all know, is that the Oregon Bill of Rights is separate language. It's distinct. We have many provisions on religious exercise and a strict Article 1, Section 5. And even in Cooper, they said, we don't analyze this the same way that the federal courts do. So it adds to the complicated nature. But let me pull up, and the Dash 2 amendments were prepared in conjunction with Americans United for Separation of Church and State that actually wants to. They've provided a written statement here. They cannot be here. The nature of the last minute. They, though, have a desire and have had the desire to try to get to language that would craft something that would be workable, reduce litigation, and provide a standard. And the concerns we have with the current bill is the subsection 4F of the Workplace Religious Freedom Act that's being amended. We are concerned, and let me just reference that and find my copy of that if I can. So let me back up and explain. You're repealing the law, and then what we're doing is looking at this Oregon Workplace Religious Freedom Act that was created in 2009. It is important to note that that is a unique law to Oregon, and it's a unique standard. So when we talk about this provision related to any other state in the country, how 47, 49 other states don't have the same law about religious dress here, and they haven't had problems. First of all, I think many of us want to know what are the standards. There's got to be some in place. But second of all, none of those states have the standard in the Workplace Religious Freedom Act that gives employees the ability to wear religious dress possibly over the objections of their employer, including the school. So we can't use that for guidance either because we've got a new standard. And so that standard is the major part of what you're looking at in the bill. And the concerns with that standard right now is they talk about the employer must make accommodation for time off or dress. And the reasonableness standard, how an employer can say no, is basically an economic hardship test. And so I think everyone had recognized, including the proponents of this legislation, that an economic test doesn't work for the schools. In fact, it doesn't work for the public employer. It doesn't allow them a way to say that's too far. So that's the context of this and where our amendments are going to try to fit in. The concerns we have with this specific language is the states the degree to which an accommodation may constrain the obligation of a school district to maintain a religiously neutral work environment. Degree to which suggests that there's a degree to which at a certain point it's too much and constitutional violations aren't done in degrees. It's also a work environment, and this is really not a work environment, it's a school environment. So what we have proposed with the dash two amendments, and I will now get to those, Chair, and walk you through, are four fixes.
Ms. Meyer, can you get through it in about 2 to 3 minutes?
I think
know this
so.
Is important, but I have quite a few people, and I only have this room for
right.
19 more minutes.
I will get to it, and I've provided you a cheat sheet. But, Senator Ferriola, you said give some definition to rulemaking in dress. Because of a disruptive standard, and we're trying to put that in because the standards aren't there. So quickly, adding the language to the law in accordance with an employee's sincerely held religious belief, that gets to trying to limit it to that an employee can invoke that it's a religious belief that they have, that they want accommodation for, but needs to be sincerely held, and that's a legal standard. Number two, adding in general language to the employer section to the ability of an employer to refuse accommodation if it would create a demeaning, harassing, hostile, intimidating, or coercive work environment. National groups that support this Workplace Religious Freedom Act nationally, the coalition, support that language. What it means is when an employer is faced with an employee who wants to wear a button that is so offensive but says, indeed, they must because of their sincerely held religious belief, and that's been done, that's been challenged, this gives an employer to say, that is creating such an intimidating, hostile work environment that's too much. Number three, it adds language to the public employer work environment because there's nothing there right now to allow a public employer, a police department, to say when a police officer is wearing a uniform, it needs to have no religious garb on it. And it adds a provision for the schools also. You've heard a lot of invocation of the current law, the provision being religiously neutral. That doesn't help because religiously neutral still will mean allowing religious dress. You just can't discriminate. And so we have added some specific language to ensure that it doesn't give the impression of endorsing religion, maintains a religiously neutral workplace. And Senator Ferriola, if you'll look at our amendments, we also include that the school retains the ability to maintain order and discipline so it's not disruptive. You need those tools and statutory language for rulemaking so that those things can be stopped when they go too far. If they're not in statutory language, rulemaking may not assist, and the teachers will pursue a challenge saying under the law, I can do this.
Okay, thank you. I'm actually going to go in the reverse order now.
Okay.
So
no
that
questions?
I can get, no questions. I'm going to go in the reverse order now so I can get the people who are not normally always here.
Thank you.
Let's see, who should we go to first? Ms. Saba Ahmed and Doug Clayville. If you both would come forward. And I'm going to try to get to everyone, so if you could limit your testimony to no more than 3 minutes each.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Devlin and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Saba Ahmed, and I represent the Oregon Muslim Citizens Alliance. I just want to address a few comments and answer a few questions that were raised. The definition of religious dress does not exist. That's been the core fundamental argument for us, has been that each school district has their own interpretation. What's being allowed in Woodburn school districts, for instance, Russian Christian Orthodox women regularly wear headscarves, and they are accommodated. In other school districts, the same headscarves are not accommodated for Muslim women. Under the Cooper case, religious symbols are allowed. The wearing of the cross and Star of David and such symbols are allowed. But religious dress, such as the headscarf or the yarmulke or the Sikh turban, is not allowed. Specifically in the Cooper case, Janet Cooper was a special ed teacher who was fired for wearing a white turban as part of her Sikh faith. And ultimately, she lost her teacher's license, and she even moved out of state and was not able to get her teaching certification back because her Oregon record followed her. So she had a very devastating consequence of the case, and she several years later, she even changed her faith because she was so traumatized by losing her job, career, home, and everything in Oregon. And her attorney, Ron Roberts, actually submitted written testimony at the House hearing, if you were interested in looking at that. The other thing I wanted to address was several students have changed their majors, and in Oregon Muslim Citizens Alliance, we have several teachers who have faced discrimination. They've been asked to take off their headscarves or have been just flatly denied employment. After going through the whole job interview process, they've gotten their master's in education degrees and have gotten certified but have been denied. And so what most end up doing is teaching in private schools or going across the border to teach in Vancouver, because most of them live in Portland. But we hope that by supporting this bill, they will be able to apply and get employment in public schools going forward. And we hope to get your support. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Douglas Clayville, and I'm the Oregon Vice President of the Northwest Religious Liberty Association, and I'm here to speak in favor of this bill. And would like to see the old statutes repealed, the ORS 342, 650, and 655, because the statutes disproportionately impact people of minority faiths whose religious commitments and obligations direct them to dress modestly and in ways that demonstrate their religious fealty. And secondly, there's no evidence that this is a problem on either the national or local scope, or that students would necessarily gain the impression that a teacher is attempting to impose his or her religious beliefs simply by wearing distinctively religious dress. And this old statute also unnecessarily burdens the religious conduct of people because of their faith. In other words, it discriminates against people who wear religiously distinctive clothing because of their religious commitments. And I'd like to share a little bit of a personal view. I was born and raised in Oregon here, and however, I've had the privilege of living for 18 years in Asia. For a small part of that, I lived in Singapore. You're probably aware that Singapore is really an amalgamation of ethnicities, of languages, and religions. So I was impressed because people did not appear to be threatened or fearful of other people's faiths or of no faith. You know, Buddhists, Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs, Christians, and people of no faith seem to live quite peacefully together. On any given day, I saw students and teachers wearing their unique cultural or religious garb. Even when the students or others were required to wear uniforms, they were allowed to wear their religiously required clothing also. So I'd like to see Oregonians and perhaps all Americans be able to come to the point where we can allow others to be different from ourselves and not feel threatened by those differences and perhaps even enjoy some of the differences of people. And one other thing, we cannot deny that children notice if their teachers dress differently from the norm. I have an adopted daughter who's developmentally delayed, and she is a second grade student at Oakdale Heights Elementary School in Dallas over here. One of the aides at the school belongs to a Christian group that requires women to dress very modestly and to wear a white head cap. I don't know what else you'd call it. My daughter notices the difference in the way she dresses, and she asked my wife and me about it. You know, it was a great opportunity for us to explain the differences in people, you know, the choices they make and the lifestyles they choose. And I feel like if a developmentally delayed second grader is able to learn that it's okay for people to be different and to think and believe differently, and I'll say this with a smile, I hope that well-educated legislators could allow people, including teachers, to believe and live conscientiously according to their faith. Thank you.
Thank you both. Okay. We will go to Jonathan Sanford, Cindy Hunt, and Stephen Green. Okay. Please start in whichever order you choose.
I'll go fairly quickly. My name is Jonathan Sanford. I'm the student body president of Portland State and also a student myself. All I had is just two quick comments, and for the chair and the rest of the committee. First of all, that I represent around 30,000 students at Portland State University, and a wide variety of them are international students. International students come in with a wide variety of cultural experiences and systems of living that maybe people from Oregon, maybe from a town like I'm from, Boring, are not used to, you know. And I think this needs to be a very well-welcomed bill. And the reason is because in a lot of places in Oregon, these conversations may not be happening. But as the conversation about people having freedom to wear what they would like to wear and about who they are needs to be allowed so that people aren't pushed out because of their cultural systems, because of the ways they're living. And so I just wanted to try to bring this to the furthest point, if I may bring to you guys. If you look at this as a system of living for a family, and someone decided they wanted to have a headscarf or any type of clothing, they have children underneath them, and they have a system of their family that operates. You'd never want to say to that family that, no, you can't be part of what we are in Oregon, because of the way you look, because of the way you dress. And this is effectively, by supporting 3686, it effectively makes sure that people who are from different cultures, who have different systems of living, are allowed to still be part of our system. And when I came back, I used to be in the Army for 8 years. I had definitely a slanted view about things. And I've gone through things like watching Hijabi monologues, which I suggest all you guys go through. It's wonderful. It's a change of focus about how you see people. And I think having the conversations in the school system and continuing on is very important. So I just want to say that as a Portland State student, with international students, we have an education program. We think it's vital that you need to support 3686. And, of course, we don't have any time, so I don't want to take up any more. But if you have questions for me, I'd love to answer them. So thank you.
Okay. We'll go to questions at the end of the panel if we have time.
Cindy Hunt, Legal Affairs Coordinator, Department of Education. I've also provided you with written testimony today. I was asked to come before you and talk about the education laws that exist that afford students, teachers, and other people who interact with our school systems protections around religious discrimination and also school districts endorsing religion. So in my written testimony, I have listed there about 8 statutes. I'm only going to focus on 2 in respect for your time. But essentially, the gist of it is that any student, any person, any parent who feels like their school district is either discriminating against them based on religion or endorsing a particular religion has the ability to file a complaint with the superintendent of public instruction. The way that these often work is first they go through their local districts and attempt to resolve the dispute there. And that most of the time, that's what happens. It doesn't get to this level. But they do have that remedy. And one of the things that I wanted to emphasize is that in the bill, it doesn't impact these other statutes. It doesn't repeal these statutes. It doesn't amend them. So the fear that there's going to be religious endorsement or something like that, there are some remedies out there for individuals. Also, legislators can file complaints under these statutes and have done so in the past. So it's not just restricted to students. The other thing that the point I wanted to make kind of in conclusion is that another fear I think that's been expressed by some folks is that this would place additional burdens on districts to weigh religious issues or something. Districts have to deal with these issues right now on a daily basis, and they'll have to continue doing so regardless of what you do today. I'm sure that you've seen some of these cases come up in the papers, such as Christmas trees in lobbies down south, for example, came up a couple of months ago, and that district dealt with it at a local level in a manner that was addressed its community needs. And that's frequently what our districts do. So with that, if you have any questions, I'm available.
Mr. Green.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, I'm Stephen Green. I'm professor of law and director of the Willamette University Center for Religion, Law, and Democracy. I have taught, studied, and litigated in this area for more than 20 years. I strongly support this bill, and not because it will give more jobs to my students, because I believe it's very important that we repeal this bill. This bill discriminates against people because of their faith, and it is not necessary in order to ensure a religiously neutral work environment. I've litigated numerous cases across the country in this area, and I can only And we know of a couple of instances when religious garb was ever used in any way to try to proselytize children, and it was always in conjunction with something else. I mean, this clearly, the law that's in existence now is clearly a solution in search of a problem. It just does not exist. Conversely, it does discriminate against people because of their religion. The Oregon Supreme Court said that in the Cooper decision, and I've submitted my testimony and also a memorandum on law about the constitutionality of the existing law, and contrary to what the Attorney General has suggested, I believe this law actually is unconstitutional as it is written, and there have been two recent federal district court decisions dealing with the law in Pennsylvania where they found the law both discriminates and have also found that it is not necessary in order to ensure that you have a religiously neutral school environment. And so with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions about the bill or about any of the amendments.
Any questions? We have a few minutes left before we lose the room.
Question for the panel.
Yes.
Have any of you seen the movie that was produced in Portland called Lord Save Us From Your Followers?
I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it.
No one else has seen it. I would highly suggest that. I'm a big supporter of the movie, but there's a portion of the film that reminds me of your comment about Christmas trees, in which the city of St. Paul, not exactly a bastion of conservatism, bans the Easter Bunny because they felt that the Easter Bunny was religious expression. And I am very curious as it relates to the Easter Bunny precedent that was eventually worn out in St. Paul, a city named after a major biblical figure. If that has any bearing on our discussion about religious garb in Oregon. If you haven't seen it, it's fine. It's an archaic question, but I would recommend you see it, as this topic isn't about to go away anytime soon.
Any, would you care to respond at all, Professor Reagan?
Chair Devin, just real briefly. I think just this gets, as Cindy Hunt just said, the complexity of these issues sometimes. They're dealt day in and day out in public school context. Schools know how to address these issues. And quite clearly with the concern about how you go about defining religion by virtue of the language in the bill that says sincerely held religious belief, and there are some legal standards out there that the courts have used in this area, I think the state will be well equipped in order to address these issues.
Actually, I believe that, comment, Mr. Chair,
yes.
I think Commissioner Vakian was dead on in setting up the essential local justification for what is and what is not acceptable. I think that that is the standard that we need to move to. I'm actually afraid of an overall statewide standard that says no to everything, essentially, and in that case sets us up for something as ridiculous as banning the Easter Bunny.
Any additional
comments?
Mr. Chair? Yes. Senator
Ferriola.
Which is not a religious symbol.
The issue was raised that I think is going to be fascinating to define, and that is, what is a cultural lifeway or pattern or expression, and what is a religious lifeway pattern or expression? And as I was listening to the student body representative, I was thinking to myself, I think I would feel welcomed and safe walking across the Portland State University campus with a crescent, moon, and star as a symbol, or a crucifix as a symbol, or as a, with the Star of David. But I don't think I would feel safe on that campus with the Bush, the president, button. Just to be interesting to see what's cultural and what's religious.
Indeed.
Any additional questions? Okay. Thank you very much for coming today. Thank you for the content of this hearing. Stand by for future action on this bill. With that, close public hearing. We are adjourned.